Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the so-called nuclear experts get it wrong. This week, I have a special extended report on the two high-level events that took place on the East Coast last week. The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident, ongoing lessons. The first one on Indian Point that was held in New York, and the other on the Pilgrim nuclear power plant in Massachusetts. I attended both events and have an overview of the two sessions, excerpts from several speeches, and some perspective that only comes with having been on site. That will be coming up in just a few minutes. Today is Tuesday, October 15, 2013, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Let's start with a new feature, the Abe Baby Report, wherein we follow the wild and crazy antics of Japan's current Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, as he lies, obfuscates, bullies, and tries to deny that he's got Armageddon cooking the Pacific on his northeast prefecture coast. As you may recall, in politicking to land the 2020 Olympics for his radiation-soaked country, Abe Baby told the International Olympic Committee and the world, and here I quote, "Let me assure you, the situation is under control. There are no health-related problems until now, nor will there be in the future." This, of course, ignores the more than 40 confirmed thyroid cancer cases in Fukushima children. The esophageal cancer that killed the leader of the Fukushima 50, Masao Yoshida, or the current spate of reports from Fukushima workers that they have started to receive surgery for cancer. No, of course, all that radiation couldn't possibly have any relationship to cancer or health-related problems, could they, Mr. Pinocchio Abe Baby? So the IOC gave the Olympics to Japan, thus linking the one thing no one in the world wants to think about, meaning nuclear issues, with the one thing the entire world pays attention to, which is the Olympics. And the world has been paying attention. South Korea, Russia, and China now ban imports of Japanese fish from up to 10 prefectures. Researchers, scientists, engineers, professors in the nuclear field have been telling reporters around the world of the problems being faced, and they're saying it with more openness than they've ever done before. To their credit, the world's mainstream media is starting to pay attention as well. After all, it's not just a nuclear annihilation we're asking them to cover. It's the Olympics. Well, Abe Baby, naked emperor that you are, you had told the IOC that the effect of contaminated water was contained. And you were damned if you weren't going to make it so. So you told TEPCO to clean up the mess. Yeah, right, just what they need to motivate them in the face of this ongoing nuclear catastrophe. A tongue-lashing before being sent to their room without supper. So Abe visited Fukushima wearing a fashionable full face mask and white Tyvek protective suit with his names misspelled on the back. Abe Baby came out beaming at reporters. He said, "I am convinced the impact of wastewater is completely blocked within 0.3 square kilometers inside the bay, as I said in Buenos Aires." He pledged to, quote, "work hard to counter rumors questioning the safety of the Fukushima plant." He also told TEPCO, quote, "to resolve the leaky water problem by setting a timeline." Of course, that's what was needed. A timeline! How silly that we didn't think of it before. So TEPCO, all by themselves, little corporate utility that they are, decided that as of this November, yes, November 2013, They are going to start removing the highly radioactive fuel rods from spent fuel pool 4. As Arnie Gunderson explained on Nuclear Hot Seat number 117, removing these rods is like trying to pull cigarettes out of a pack. Except here, the pack is scrunched up, the cigarettes aren't straight, there's no computer system to regulate this, so it has to be done by hand, and if a rod breaks or two rods get too close together, they could ignite a fire or even a nuclear recriticality, meaning boom! Oops! There goes the so-called spent fuel pool, in which the fuel isn't really spent at all, but carrying weapons-grade plutonium and radiation the equivalent of 14,000 Hiroshima bombs, tra-la-tra-la. But hey, TEPCO's in charge. What could go wrong? That was in late September. Since that time, a letter signed by Dr. Helen Caldicott, Arnie Gunderson, and 15 other nuclear experts from around the world was sent to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, asking for international intervention by a coalition of doctors, engineers, technicians, nuclear experts of every stripe, to work together to try to solve the immediate problems at the site. In other words, get TEPCO out of the picture before they blow us all to kingdom come. Harvey Wasserman of Solartopia started a people's petition asking for the international scientific and technical community to act now on the Fukushima disaster and the ongoing contamination of the Pacific Ocean. To date, Harvey's petition at nukefree.org, also showing up at moveon.org, has received more than 95,000 signatures from the global community. A second petition covering the same information is at rootsaction.org, and that one has received 40,000 signatures. So that's 135,000 signatures that Harvey will be taking to the UN this November 11th. So where does all this leave Prime Minister Abe Baby? Well, the poor boy looks like he's starting to crack. On October 8th, he called on the world's scientific communities to help solve the problems facing Fukushima Prefecture and the disabled nuclear power plant. He said, "We have learned, in the most painful way, the importance of science and technology in society, by which I mean Fukushima and its aftermath." Now dig it. He said, "We're wide open to receive the most advanced knowledge from overseas to contain the problem. My country needs your knowledge." Oh, really? What happened to your mission accomplished moment, Mr. Prime Minister Baby? Situation not under control? Finding a few health-related problems now? See them happening in the future? Has political backpedaling become the new Olympic sport? Stay tuned. Last week, there was no new Nuclear Hot Seat because I was in the middle of a last-minute whirlwind trip to the East Coast to cover the Fukushima nuclear accident, ongoing lessons events in New York City, which focused on the Indian Point nuclear power plant, and in Boston, where the Pilgrim nuclear power plant across from Cape Cod was the subject. Both events proved powerful, important, and marked a milestone in the fight against each nuclear reactor. What follows is but a brief roundup of some of the high points, and there were so many, from some of the speakers. Know that if you want to listen to either event or both events in their entirety, they are currently posted at new.livestream.com/Fukushima Lessons/, and then put in either New York or Boston. No underlines, no spaces. In addition, the individual speeches will be up shortly on YouTube. Initially, we participants were greeted by a video from Jean-Michel Cousteau, son of Jacques Cousteau, who could not attend because of prior commitments, but had an important framing concept for the events.
My initial introduction to the ocean by my father, Jacques Cousteau, impressed upon me some important fact about our planet. These were, we live on a planet bathed in two fluids, the ocean, and the atmosphere. These fluids are in constant motion, each interacting with the other, and each reaching every corner of the planet. Because of these facts, nothing can be thrown away because there is no away. Everything is connected, and whatever pollutant is released anywhere on the planet has the potential to have impacts everywhere. I believe these facts are particularly relevant to the discussion about nuclear power. Human arrogance and error are part of reality, as are natural disasters totally out of our control. This means that it is absolutely certain that there will be unpredictable events capable of upsetting the best of our human engineered enterprises. In the case of a power, human error and natural disaster may topple a wind generator, damage a photovoltaic panels, and even destroy a petroleum-based power plant. But the consequences of these will be microscopic compared to the impact of a nuclear power plant going down. This has been proven true with the Fukushima and Chernobyl catastrophes. Those who choose to ignore the past are doomed to repeat it. I urge you to learn from Fukushima and Chernobyl so we don't have to see these catastrophes repeated. I applaud all of you for addressing the important issue of nuclear power plant, and trust you will think of your children and all future generations to come as you make important policy decisions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you, and hope that great decisions can be made for the future of our species.
A planet bathed in two fluids, air and water. What a great, clear concept.
The first live speaker in both New York and Boston was former Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan, who was head of that country when the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster began. He used his time to explain, through an interpreter, the difficulties he faced following the unprecedented three-reactor meltdown, then stated clearly that he had made a 180-degree change in attitude towards nuclear reactors since he first took office, and was now completely against nuclear power. That's a former world leader who got caught in office when a nuclear disaster happened. Other world leaders need to take note, especially those who think nuclear is a good idea. There will be more from and about Mr. Kan during today's final thought. The next speaker was Gregory Yasko, former chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission during Fukushima. He spoke clearly and powerfully about the myths of nuclear safety and how they were contradicted by the nuclear disaster in Japan.
There were many, many significant myths that were challenged. The most probably important was the myth that I think had developed here in the United States, that had developed throughout the world with people in principle who use technology different from Soviet or Russian reactor technology. And there was a myth that had developed that accidents would not happen, in particular severe accidents, would not happen in these reactor types. You would never see an accident progress beyond a minimal release of radiation contained within the nuclear reactor buildings that are designed to do that. And in fact, at the NRC, we would annually conduct exercises to simulate these reactor accidents. And there was always discussions about how complicated and convoluted we had to make these scenarios to actually ever get to an accident or to a simulated release that we could then test the emergency response capabilities. Of course, Mother Nature has a way of confounding all of us and came up with a very simple way at Fukushima. So that first myth of accidents never happening was challenged. And not only was it challenged once, but it was challenged three times. Three reactors ultimately underwent severe accidents at the Fukushima site. A number, again, that was very unusual and unexpected to see a single reactor site have three reactors simultaneously undergoing a severe accident. As we look at the accident and what happened, one of the next important myths that was challenged was that any release of radiation would be small and would be contained within the reactor buildings and the containment structures that were designed specifically to do that. Of course, that was not the case at the Fukushima Daiichi site. And one of the reasons was because of the hydrogen explosions that occurred early on in the accident. Again, an area that many had believed had been properly addressed and properly dealt with so that even if there was an accident that became serious, the impacts of hydrogen would not lead to the kinds of explosions that were seen. Of course, this was an issue, and perhaps Peter Bradford will talk more about it, this was an issue that developed at Three Mile Island. As the fuel melt began, ultimately there was an accumulation of hydrogen in the containment building at the Three Mile Island site. So for decades, this has been a known phenomenon. Systems were put in place, procedures were developed, and methodologies were established to ensure that in the event of an accident, a hydrogen explosion would not occur. So again, a myth and a belief that was challenged. Another that was significantly confronted, and again was a legacy of the Three Mile Island accident, was that we had understood finally how to properly conduct emergency plans and implement emergency plans and conduct emergency evacuations. Clearly, the accident in Fukushima showed that those plans are never as simple to implement as they appear to be, and that unique challenges always occur, which make those even more difficult to implement in reality than we can ever imagine. And finally, as Prime Minister Khan touched on, we shattered the myth that we fully understand all the natural hazards that can impact nuclear power plants, not only in Japan, but of course throughout the world.
Dr. Yasko brought up the likelihood of future accidents at nuclear power facilities.
First and foremost, we have to recognize what it's telling us, that severe accidents can and most likely will happen at some point. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not in 10 years, maybe not in 30 years. But they will happen. There will be ways that Mother Nature, that human mistakes and errors, will lead to these kinds of severe accidents at nuclear power plants. But moreover, what this accident is telling us is that society does not accept the consequences from these severe accidents. Society does not ultimately find it acceptable to evacuate hundreds of thousands of people, to have areas of land be permanently contaminated, to spend close to $500 billion or more dollars to deal with the aftermath of an accident at a facility that is simply designed to generate electricity. So what this accident fundamentally should be telling us is that for nuclear power plants to be considered safe, nuclear power plants should not produce accidents like this. And by should not, I don't mean that they have a low probability or that they have a very little likelihood or that they have a 1 in 10 million year probability. I mean simply that they should not be able to produce accidents like this. That is what the public has said quite clearly after the Fukushima accident. And that is, I think, quite clearly what we need to use as a new safety standard for nuclear power going forward. Now, turning to the United States, I think when we look at the impact of the accident in the United States, there's an unfortunate reality that too many people continue to believe that an accident will not happen here in the United States. And as time goes on and no accidents happen, that belief will continue to increase. But I think it's extremely important that we focus on this issue and focus on trying to address these challenges now to ensure that we don't suffer the kind of accidents that we saw at Fukushima Daiichi here in the United States.
He went on to point out nuclear near misses from natural causes here in the United States.
Now, I talked about one of these tremendous myths about nuclear power, that we fully understand natural hazards. And in the context here of the United States, in this idea that, well, the Fukushima accident was a Japanese accident. It recognized and it pointed to problems in the Japanese system. I simply think that's not true. Around the time of the accident at Fukushima, and while that accident was continuing to transpire, we had our own challenges with natural hazards here in the United States. A plant in Nebraska, the Fort Calhoun Station, experienced significant flooding. Flooding, in fact, that it exceeded the planned design limits for the plant itself. But thanks to some intrepid work by an NRC inspector and staff of the NRC, the challenge with this flooding was identified prior to the actual flooding event, and emergency systems and additional measures were put in place to protect the plant. And that was done just about a year before the plant actually experienced incredibly significant flooding that caused that plant to shut down, and a plant that then has had a number of significant safety challenges that have required it to undergo a very significant oversight review and to be shut down for an extended period of time. At the same time, here on the East Coast, we experienced an earthquake that was small compared to the earthquake in Japan, but nonetheless an earthquake that exceeded the design specifications for a plant very near to the earthquake site in Virginia. Thankfully, that plant did not experience any significant impacts, but again, it showed us that our thinking and our understanding of the limits on Mother Nature have been too low and we've underestimated.
In conclusion, the former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission put out a call to find new technologies that forego the dangers of nuclear.
So ultimately, when we look to the future, I think we have to recognize the challenges with nuclear power. There are promises from nuclear power, but there certainly are challenges. And I think we have to recognize that we should challenge ourselves to do better, that this is an expensive technology that always has the risk for these kinds of severe accidents. And we have to ask ourselves if we cannot do better, if we cannot figure out a better way in 10, 20, or 30 years to generate electricity. I believe we can. I believe in this country, when we present ourselves with these kinds of challenges, we're able to meet them. And so as we look to the future, I'm reminded of the country that invented the light bulb. I think we can do better. We can invent a new way to power those light bulbs. We can invent a new way to light our homes and provide for all our electronic devices that are such a necessity for us these days in a way that doesn't pose the risk of severe contamination of land around nuclear power plants or the displacement of hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of people from their homes for an extended period of time. That, to me, is the future that I think we should be striving for and one that I think we can meet.
I need to acknowledge Dr. Yasko for his powerful inclusion of the human tragedy of Fukushima in his speech. His story of visiting a Japanese elder whose world was completely and permanently shattered by the accident provided a moving counterpoint to the facts and figures so prevalent in the day's presentations. You can hear Gregory Yasko's entire speech on the live stream website under Fukushima Lessons, no space or underscore, or as I said, within the week on YouTube. Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education, fairwinds.com or .org, is an ever-reliable source for translating complex nuclear issues into normal, understandable English. That's so people like myself, who are not nuclear engineers, can understand what's being discussed and what's at stake. Here, Arne addresses the psychology behind the self-deceptions within the nuclear industry.
Sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. When someone's brain reasons a way to justify support for something you want to be true, psychologists call that motivated reasoning. Now, there's a lot of motivated reasoning at the NRC and at policymakers here in New York State about why Indian Point should be allowed to move forward.
Arne then moved into his central thesis, which is that despite the best intentions and skills of the individuals who work at them, Nuclear reactors need only one bad day to take away any perceived advantages in the technology.
Well, if history has taught us anything, it's that nuclear accidents happen despite the best intentions of the men and women who work at them. I knew the operators at Three Mile Island. I had people working for me during the recovery efforts on the plant site. Those operators were safety conscious as anyone. They lived in the community. Their homes were just down the street. And yet an accident happened. This is a technology that can have 40 good years to be wiped out by one bad day. After the Chernobyl accident, I got to know some of the operators at Chernobyl. They were brilliant engineers, and they were very safety conscious. They and their families lived right near the reactors, and yet an accident happened. This is a technology that can have 40 good years and one bad day. Then, after I wrote my book, Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth in the Future, I got to know some of the operators at Fukushima. And again, their families lived right down the street. They were conscientious. They were safety conscious. They knew how their plant worked like a book. They understood it completely. And yet the accident happened. 40 good years and one very bad day. Well, policymakers seem to be taking the front part of that sentence, 40 good years, to heart. But they're not taking the back part of that sentence, the one bad day part, to heart. Companies like Entergy claim their plants are safe. What exactly does that mean? Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in congressional hearings admitted that it reviews about 5% of the material and the analysis that goes into a nuclear power plant. And they check off the boxes that paperwork is actually existent. But what Entergy doesn't tell you is that the commissioners at the NRC are vetted by the industry's lobbying group called NEI, Nuclear Energy Institute, before Congress is allowed to vote on them. And this same lobbying group works with the NRC commission and the staff as they write the regulations that a nuclear plant is designed to work under. So what that means is that safe to someone like Entergy in Indian Point means that Indian Point can comply with the minimum acceptable standard established by a compliant regulator. Well, let's talk about a couple of specific items here about the corporations that own these plants. The first is the NRC about 15 years ago allowed nuclear plants to become limited liability corporations. Now, what that means is that a limited liability corporation is separate from the entity to which it reports. So we always talk about Entergy owning Indian Point or Vermont Yankee or Pilgrim. Each of those plants is its own limited liability corporation. What does that mean? That means that if Indian Point 2, which is a separate limited liability corporation from Indian Point 3, if Indian Point 2 had an accident and released radiation, it could be declared bankrupt, and Indian Point 3 would not be on the hook for that liability. Now, Entergy wouldn't do that, would they? You need only to look at Entergy's behavior after Katrina to see that they have, in fact, already behaved that way. After Katrina, while the city was bailing itself out, Entergy New Orleans, the power company that provides power to New Orleans, is a limited liability corporation. It declared bankruptcy. The corporation was making billions, but the entity that controlled New Orleans declared bankruptcy. And what happened then was that the United States government moved cash that was destined for poor families within New Orleans through the Community Development Block Grant Program and transferred it over to Entergy. And Entergy gave its executives bonuses.
Doesn't that just make your blood boil? Here, Arnie compares Indian Point, less than 30 miles from Midtown Manhattan, with Fukushima Daiichi.
Well, every day at Fairwinds, we get emails saying, It can't possibly be that the American plants are as bad as the Tsukushima Daiichi. And I thought I'd look briefly at the condition of Indian Point and compare it to Daiichi. And in many ways, Indian Point is actually worse than Fukushima Daiichi was the day before the accident. The first issue, as was alluded to already, is emergency planning with a population center as close as New York City is to Indian Point. You know, Tokyo was 120 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi. Indian Point is 26 miles up the road. Also, the Japanese were the best at emergency planning in the world. They really took emergency planning seriously. And yet the entire emergency planning system collapsed as a consequence of a severe accident where all the safety systems collapsed. If the Japanese couldn't do emergency planning right, I don't think anybody in the world can. The second thing is the condition of the spent fuel pool. Indian Point has 5 times more nuclear fuel in its spent fuel pool than does Daiichi. Indian Point has the equivalent of every bomb that was ever fired above ground in the above ground testing phases. That much radiation is in the pools at Indian Point and is not being moved to dry cask storage. The Japanese moved a lot of fuel to dry cask storage. The Japanese had about 7 years of nuclear fuel in Daiichi, whereas Indian Point has over 30. The third thing is we all know that the common view of the accident is that Daiichi's accident was caused by an earthquake followed by a tsunami. But really what happened was this: the earthquake knocked down the power lines that fed the plant. And so that's called the loss of offsite power. Then the tsunami came in and wiped out the cooling pumps along the water. It also wiped out the diesels. But even if the diesels had not been wiped out, the cooling pumps along the water were. That's called the loss of the ultimate heat sink, because you need that water to cool your diesels. So that creates something that Chairman Yasko talked about, was the station blackout. And a nuclear plant is designed to withstand that for about 4 to 8 hours. Now, can that happen at Indian Point? The answer is yes. Two people dedicated to dying as tourists could cause a loss of offsite power by shooting the transmission lines, and also drive a high-powered boat with explosives into the intake structure, which would cause a loss of the ultimate heatsink. Two terrorists could create the same problem that we experienced at Fukushima Daiichi.
No comment. Arnie wound up his speech, referring back to the nuclear dangers he had enumerated.
It's easy for the nuclear industry to allow arrogance and hubris to set in when you look at the sheer size of a nuclear power plant. Paul mentioned I went to RPI up in Troy, New York, and graduated in 72 while Indian Point was being built. And the nuclear department at RPI used to drive down to Indian Point, and we watched Indian Point being built. Both then and now, it's an impressive building. But nobody ever asked, why does it have to be impressive? What's inside those plants that requires such an impressive structure in the first place? Well, Daiichi, the accident of Fukushima Daiichi, has shown us that nuclear power systems can fail with catastrophic results. And we need to ask, should we build using such an uncontrollable and unmanageable technology? The forces in these plants are enormous, and they must always be controlled 24/7, 365. So Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and now Fukushima Daiichi have shown just how impossible it is to control an accident, to control a reaction 24/7, 365. One operator error, one significant weather event, one earthquake, or one terrorist attack, and all of New York City will face that one bad day. And like Japan, it will be one sad day.
Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.com or fairwinds.org. Ralph Nader is one of the most effective leaders of public advocacy activism and one of the most influential Americans alive today. If you ever wondered how this one man David could slay so many Goliaths, you have only to listen to the speech that he gave at the New York event on Indian Point. Powerful, concise, vivid. We only have time for a few excerpts here, but again, I urge you to listen to the entire speech to hear about nuclear from a slightly different and highly motivating perspective. Here, Mr. Nader offers a human angle on how and why nuclear energy production got started in the first place.
Nuclear power arose out of a group of scientists and engineers who harbored more than a reasonable guilt complex for the uses of their knowledge in producing the atomic bomb. And out of World War II, this guilt complex transferred to a hope that there would be atoms for peace. In 1952, President Truman's Materials Policy Committee issued a report saying that the country should go solar, and by 1975, two-thirds of all residences would be solarized. Unfortunately, 2 years later, under President Eisenhower, the country decided to go nuclear under the Atoms for Peace program. Some of our most brilliant scientists and engineers were behind that effort, coming out of the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which were deliberate targeting of civilians, to use the military's phrase in World War II, in order to, quote, terrorize the population and reduce the morale in the countries that attacked us. Just think of that. To terrorize the population. That's where that guilt complex came from. And there were many, many discussions privately between these scientists and engineers who came out of the Manhattan Project about how they could redeem themselves and the Atoms for Peace.
Here he is on the ultimate cost of nuclear energy and the ultimate goal of the technology.
The uranium mines, the uranium radioactive tailings around those mines, the development of the fuel rods, the transportation to the location where the nuclear plant is, the creation of these nuclear plants with enormous complexities, the production of radioactive waste, which still do not have a permanent waste disposal, and all the problems appurtenant to a deadly substance that had to be 100% controlled. 99% is not enough. It was a technology that had one bite of the apple. All of this, and the storage for tens of thousands of years of radioactive waste, had one purpose: to boil water, to produce steam, or other reactor designs to produce heat. Now, the question that was very rarely asked in secret congressional hearings was, aren't there other ways to boil water without all the continuum of risk involved in the nuclear fuel cycle?
Mr. Nader takes on the whole false nuclear is green argument and demolishes it, just in time for us to use his points to counter the upcoming CNN airing of the nuclear propaganda film Pandora's Promise.
It's often said that nuclear power is needed because of the climate change. Number one, you need a lot of coal to burn to enrich the uranium. That's often not mentioned. Number two, as Amory Lovins has said repeatedly, if you take the investment in nuclear and put it in solar, renewable, other forms of renewable and conservation, you'd get far more BTUs, far more efficiently, far more safely, and far more benignly for climate change. We must remember that the price we pay for nuclear power up front, we pay as consumers and as taxpayers. Tens of billions of dollars have gone into developing the science, the technology, the operating applications of nuclear power paid by you, the taxpayers. That does not show up on your electric bill. We're dealing here with a silent, cumulative form of violence that does not leave empirically sensitive traces until it's too late. Therefore, it puts the public off guard. In comparison with a fire, we know what to do. We flee the fire and or try to put it out. The silent violence of radioactivity does not provoke the sensory responses in order to activate better choices.
The silent violence of radioactivity. That phrase is a keeper. Finally, Ralph Nader made a series of charges against the nuclear industry. Just like in an episode of Sesame Street, it was a lesson in the letter U.
My list of charges against nuclear power, all of them begin with the letter U. Nuclear power is unnecessary, uneconomic, unsafe, uninsurable, unevacuable, unfinanciable, unaccountable, and undemocratic. It's unnecessary because it is not a matter of nuclear power or coal. It's a matter of nuclear power or the horrendously wonderful opportunities for conservation. We waste well over half of our energy in the United States, even by comparison with Western Europe. By comparison with realizable, practical technology, we probably waste over two-thirds. A megawatt you do not waste is a megawatt you do not have to produce. Must never forget that the fastest, quickest, cleanest, most efficient, most job-intensive, most decentralized form of energy today is not to waste it. Whether it's retrofitting buildings, motor vehicles, lighting, heating, air conditioning, industrial engines, and so on. The other alternatives are clear. Finally, solar is coming into its own. Wind power is creating more BTUs worldwide now than nuclear. And we are seeing a fast-rising local industry called rooftop solar installation, led by many, many jobs being created in California and spreading around the country. Nuclear power is uneconomic because, first of all, we pay for it in many ways beyond just the electricity bill. We pay for it, as I said, with tax dollars. We pay for it in many other collateral ways that an economy has to adjust to such a dangerous industry. National security ways, for example. It's uneconomic by the admission of the industry itself. As Peter Bradford pointed out, you're beginning to see cancellations of the recent new proposals to build nuclear plants, Florida being one. Georgia may not be far away. But in both those states, consumers were required to pay up front for the cost of the nuclear plant before a shovel hit the ground. I'll get to that in a moment. It's uneconomic because Wall Street says it's uneconomic. Warren Buffett says nuclear power is uneconomical. Wall Street will not lend utilities money to build a nuclear plant without just about 100% loan guarantee from Uncle Sam, you the taxpayer. Nuclear power cannot meet market tests. This has always intrigued me why the Tea Party right-wing free market Milton Friedman types would not come out against nuclear power. Because it's basically government-guaranteed industry. One reason, of course, is the political and economic power of a government-guaranteed industry, funneling big money to politicians and, in effect, convincing those who need convincing on other than rational grounds that there's no alternative to nuclear power. It's unsafe. It's unsafe because of earthquakes, because of human error, because of malfunctioning equipment, because of sabotage. Every nuclear plant is a national security peril. It's unsafe because there's no place acceptable by the local population to store the waste, low-level waste, high-level waste. Spent fuel rods are piling up next to nuclear power plants. That's a clear target for sabotage, if not seismic exposure. It's uninsurable from the beginning. The government had to pass the Price-Anderson Act, which in effect said that the insurance companies would not insure nuclear power. Therefore, apart from a fractional bit of insurance, the great bulk of economic risk from a nuclear power accident would be on the taxpayer's back. That's the meaning of Price-Anderson, which is renewed every decade or so. It's unevacuable, and this comes to Indian Point. Any nuclear plant that does not have a live drill to make sure that its evacuation plan is anything other than a fantasy plan cannot be allowed to operate. Indian Point is 30 miles or so north of Manhattan, much closer to New York City than Fukushima is to Tokyo. There is no practical evacuation plan that could work in that area. Not just 10 miles out, 20, 30 miles, 50 miles, you have 19 million people. People can hardly get out of New York City at rush hour time. Can anybody credibly present a scenario where, given our transportation lockups and the density of population and the panic that would occur and the lack of any drills, the lack of any practice other than paper models, that that area around Indian Point can be evacuated? And as you know, Indian Point has been rife with problems, replete with waivers, near active earthquake zones, aging, decaying. Indian Point 1 shut down years ago. Indian Point 2 and 3 up for recertification by a compliant Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Nuclear power is unfinanceable. I've gone through that. It doesn't meet a market test. It is basically a government-sanctioned and funded industry.
Nuclear energy is unnecessary, uneconomic, unsafe, uninsurable, unevacuable, unfinanceable, unaccountable, and undemocratic. Ralph Nader, would that you would make yourself available as an advisor to our movement for 1 year to lead us in strategizing, organizing, motivating, and implementing actions that include all of our generations and match or surpass the post-Three Mile Island level of activism in this country. That's what webinars are for. We'll make it easy. It'll all be digital. And oh, what a difference you could help us make. Because of time restrictions, I am not able to include all the speakers in this nuclear hot seat. My apologies to former Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Peter Bradford, on the job during Three Mile Island. He gave impressive and thorough information that backed up all the claims, warnings, and conclusions of the other panelists. Hudson River Keeper Paul Galley moderated the New York event elegantly and added his own level of expertise about the problems at the facility. And Massachusetts State Senator Daniel Wolf, a licensed pilot who brought his own understanding of the dangers of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant to the Boston event. I will be interviewing Senator Wolf for a future nuclear hot seat. If you are concerned about the Indian Point or Pilgrim nuclear reactors or any other aspect of the nuclear situation worldwide, I urge you to view the videos of this event in their entirety. They will be up for the rest of October on livestream.com/Fukushima Lessons/, and then put in the city, either New York or Boston. No spaces, underlines, or dashes necessary. They will be up on YouTube, separated out into individual speeches. You'll be able to find them by searching YouTube under Fukushima Lessons. Thanks and gratitude to the Samuel Lawrence Foundation for funding support to put on this event. Here's today's final thought. At the two panel discussions on the East Coast last week, many important topics were covered, and no single event can be all-inclusive. Yet, there was an important human factor that went missing. So during the press Q&A in Boston, I took the opportunity to talk about the elephant in the living room and ask former Prime Minister Khan a pointed series of questions.
My question is for Prime Minister Khan. You referred in your speech to having a blunt, tell-it-like-it-is style in politics, and I wish to take advantage of that stance that you spoke of. Those of us who are in contact with people in Japan know of ongoing serious health impact from radiation exposure, especially in the children. Confirmed thyroid cancers, and 70% of children tested already showing thyroid abnormalities. We have also heard repeatedly, so repeatedly that it is not a question, that doctors have been ordered to ignore all information related to radiation, and patients are cautioned prior to examination not to bring up radiation-related symptoms to their doctors if they hope to receive care. This represents planned statistical ability to deny any effect from the radiation by the so-called experts. So when you state, as you did yesterday during your interviews, that experts say that any health effects from the accident at Fukushima are inconclusive, it begs the questions. Do you actually believe that they are representing the medical truth? Are you or were you aware of the systemic manipulation of medical information of the radiation impact while you were in office? Were you involved in any way in the creation of this institutionalized system of denial? And why did you not order the evacuation of children from Japan when their mothers were crying out for you to do so?
先ほど私の講演の中でも申し上げたように、
As I said in my speech, with regards to the children's thyroid cancer, etc., yes, the iodine pills were not properly distributed in time, and that's I have a personal concern about that. Yes. Well, currently, what government is doing is to monitor the health of the people in Fukushima, and the hospitals in Fukushima are basically in charge of monitoring long-term monitoring of health. But then doctors disagree with each other whether they are, you know, observing the noticeable sort of abnormalities in terms of thyroid cancer. As you You pointed out the possibility that maybe there is a systemic sort of cover-up of the health of abnormalities, and that's something done by the government. Well, myself and then my own party is no longer in power. But as far as I can vouch for, I can tell you why I was in the office, or why our party was in the office, we did not order such systemic corruption. What I think is needed is that, of course, in Japan too, there are a lot of people who believe that there are a lot of thyroid cancer happening in among Fukushima children. So what is needed is that those people who have those data themselves, and those people who disagree with that, should discuss openly in public, and then we take it from there. And that's something what I think should happen, and I'm going to make personal effort to ensure that.
It sounds like former Prime Minister Khan has agreed to personally look into the manipulations of the post-Fukushima health system in Japan and its avoidance of anything to do with radiation. But here's the rub. After the event ended, a member of the audience who was a native Japanese speaker told me that what the translator said was not what Prime Minister Khan said, that what he said was closer to, "The government will have to look into it." That would be a very different message. Now, I don't know Japanese, but there are individuals within our community who listen to Nuclear Hot Seat who do know the language. So perhaps they could give a listen to the Boston event, particularly my interchange with Prime Minister Khan. It comes in the Boston recording at 4 hours, 4 minutes, and 30 seconds. If you can provide a definitive interpretation of what he said, that would be great. But here's the thing. And I address it directly to Mr. Khan. I don't care if what you said is different from what your interpreter reported to the rest of us. What we heard was, what is needed is that those people who have those, didn't understand the words there, but I think she meant people who have complaints about the medical system, and those people who disagree with that should discuss openly in public, and then I will take it from there. And that's something that I think should happen, and I am going to take personal effort to ensure that. We're going to hold you to that, Mr. Khan. We need you to investigate the medical situation, the manipulations of data that have been reported to us, created by doctors being prohibited from talking about radiation as they do their jobs, and patients being prevented from stating their medical truth as it relates to radiation. We are going to hold you to paying attention to the children of Fukushima, the state of their health, their physical needs, getting them the help they need today, tomorrow, and into the everlasting future. You owe them that. It is a karmic debt, Mr. Khan, one that you will never be able to pay off completely. But by doing your best, by devoting yourself with a vigor of intention and a humble heart, you will go some of the distance to putting the situation right, and perhaps earn, if not the respect, at least a more neutral tolerance of the mothers and children of Fukushima. Do not side with the devils, Mr. Khan. You've already come a great distance. It's time for you to go the rest of the way. Dedicate yourself to those children to guarantee that they do not become history's pawns in an endgame that no one can win. It is both the least and the most that you can do.
This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Wednesday, October 15, 2013. Thanks to ENE News and the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community for all your support and the many hugs that I got while I was on the East Coast. Many thanks to Scott Portsline, security consultant to Three Mile Island Alert, for his help in getting me clear audio from the conferences. Archives available on iTunes or at nuclearhotseat.com/blog. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that San Onofre is still shut down forever, and we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.